people need ordering principles.
12 rules.
Hello, and welcome to 12 Rules to What? This is a podcast about fascism, anti-fascism, and the far right, and my name is Alex. A few things before I begin, like usual, if you want to support the show, you can do so on Patreon, patreon.com/12rulestowhat. You get access to early episodes, and we're starting to put up some new mini episodes. There's one up already, and we'll be doing some more. We're also a member of the Channel Zero Network of anarchist podcasts, so you should go check them out at channelzeronetwork.com, I believe. Other than that, follow us on social media at 12 Rules to What on Twitter and on Instagram. Now we've got an interview with Alex Carter, who's a writer who's been and researcher has been researching the Cable Street Beat, which was the cultural wing of anti-fascist action. So we've got a really good conversation for you. On with the show. So now I'm joined by Alex Carter, who's a research fellow at Birmingham University, who's doing work on British anti-fascism to discuss the Cable Street Beat. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
No worries. So first of all, I guess for people who don't know, what was the Cable Street Beat and why were you particularly interested in writing and researching about it?
Cable Street Beat were a anti-fascist music organization set up by Anti-Fascist Action in 1988. Anti-Fascist Action being the dominant, I suppose the dominant anti-fascist organization, full stop, actually, in the UK at the time. And I suppose in terms of why it was formed, there was a number of factors contributing to this. Throughout the 80s, the far right had been getting their shit together, and you know, they've been kind of, after the disaster of the 1979 general election, they'd kind of been consolidating and growing and getting more aggressive, and one of the ways that was manifesting was an attacks on any kind of left-wing gig. So for instance, a relatively famous example is the Jobs for Change festival in 1984 in London, where Billy Bragg and the Redskins were playing, and a group of National Front thugs, including the notorious Nicky Crane, attacked whilst the Redskins were playing. And there were like a few other kind of fairly symbolic gigs that were attacked, or at least Anti-Fascist Action saw them as being quite symbolic. And so like the Pogues, Desmond Dekker, and the Angelic Upstarts, who are kind of what AFA interpreted as this being as expressions of the far right's kind of anti-Irish, anti-Black, and anti-socialist sentiment. And I suppose the other kind of major contributing factor was the growth in specifically far right music organizations. So you had like Rock Against Communism coming in shortly after Rock Against Racism, and then the White Noise Club, and then finally and most importantly Blood and Honor, who I think were formed in 1988, perhaps. I could be wrong on that, but anyway, this kind of really worried anti-fascist action because they were pretty successful. You know, they were reaching a lot of ears, and anti-fascist action were concerned that they were going to be able to kind of tap into disaffected youth, specifically working class disaffected youth, you know, using exciting and angry music to tap into their frustrations and spread their far right ideas. So yeah, I mean, they were obviously as well, I mean, they were inspired by Rock Against Racism, Cable Street Beat, that is, who, you know, were wildly successful the decade earlier, and similarly wanted to use music and politics as a tool against the far right to engage with people and, you know, recruit people and spread their ideas. And in terms of why I was interested in writing about or researching and writing about them, I think it's just that unfortunately they've been a bit overshadowed by Rock Against Racism. You see, you know, there's been books and books and books and articles written about Rock Against Racism, and with good reason, right? It was a massive cultural moment, but almost nothing has been written about Cable Street Beat, which is a shame because they, you know, I think they did have a considerable impact politically and culturally. So I wanted to kind of shed some light on them.
Maybe just on the kind of distinctions and comparisons between Cable Street Beat and Rock Against Racism, because I think it's quite a useful, there's useful contrast we can draw. How did the AFA, who set up Cable Street, like you say, they took inspiration, but how also did they distinguish their efforts and their project from Rock Against Racism?
I think, I suppose, one of the key ways is that they, and this is the fact they said as much in their literature at the time, was that they were specifically, I think the term they used was practical support for practical action. So they weren't just putting on big gigs to attract thousands of people. They were specifically trying to raise money for campaigns for anti-fascists who had been, you know, arrested in the course of anti-fascist activities. So yeah, so there was the practical side of things that they, I think they felt that they did a bit better than Rock Against Racism. I think they also it's probably fair to say that they were aware that they faced limitations that Rock Against Racism didn't. You know, they knew they were smaller scale, so they weren't trying to put on gigs to the same events to the same scale. They were trying to put on gigs in pubs primarily. Yeah, and then I suppose the other side is the more militant elements of their activism. So I mean, Cable Street Beat was largely, well, almost entirely cultural, but the anti-fascist action in kind of concert with that also, you know, use militant tactics against the far right to prevent them from doing the same, from putting on gigs, from spreading ideas in a way that Rock Against Racism never did.
I suppose that relationship between the militant movement and the cultural side of things is what is particularly interesting, especially in our context as well, in that one was designed to feed into the other. And, you know, shutting down a far right gig would allow Cable Street Beat and shutting down the far right music scene would allow Cable Street Beat to grow and be successful, yeah, and raise money and not have their gig shut down. But yeah, then also you had the cultural side of it, raising money for those people facing court or other legal troubles because of their anti-fascism, or like just getting more people interested in militant anti-fascism as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, talking to people who were involved with Cable Street Beat at the time, you know, there was an awareness that there were these kind of cultural spaces, and it was kind of a zero-sum game. You know, if the far right were successful in the punk scene and the oi scene, then anti-fascists couldn't. So they were trying to clear cultural space for themselves at the expense of the far right. So yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, in making sure that the far right couldn't put on their gigs, couldn't organize, couldn't operate, it meant that they could, that they were more free to. That because there was, you know, the far right specifically tried to threaten, you know, leftist or anti-fascist bands. A particular example is the Angelic Upstarts, and who were, you know, an anti-fascist oi band, and Blood and Honor, you know, made this big deal of saying they'll never be able to play London ever again, you know, and if you do, then, you know, we'll attack you. And so, of course, the Angelic Upstarts did play, and AFA, Anti-Fascist Action, stewarded it, and there wasn't really any trouble, and it was fine. But, you know, there was this kind of this tug of war, this battle over that cultural space between the far right and the anti-fascists.
I guess it's something that we're only just starting to see again in this contest, like this contestation of both youth scenes and cultural scenes that the far right are starting to do now. And it's, we haven't had that for a long time. Like they were really successful in shutting this kind of thing down. And maybe if you could, I guess you mentioned Blood and Honor and you mentioned the White Noise Club. Like maybe if you could go into a bit more detail about what was like the kind of nitty gritty of how these things worked, because it's hard. I think it's hard for us to understand, like, here in 2024, like, what kind of threat the far right posed. I suppose.
Yeah.
I suppose what I'm trying to say is, like, now we have like the governmental far right, and we have the kind of EDL street movement, which was never really interested in shutting down cultural stuff or inserting themselves into cultural spaces. Yeah. And yeah, I guess maybe get that across a little more.
Yeah. So I guess. I think, we have to go back to Rock Against Racism, right, which I think started in 1976. And so that was just this massively influential, hugely impactful event. You know, so people always talk about the two main carnivals, which I think attracted like 80,000 and then 100,000 kids, right,
yeah,
to the festival. Yeah, I mean, really, like, they were just hugely. And it was kind of, you know, part of this was because Rock Against Racism very successfully hitched their wagon to, you know, the emerging punk scene, which was exciting, and it kind of, you know, attracted huge numbers of youths. And they had, you know, they had the endorsement of like the Clash, you know, Tom Robinson Band, the Stiff Little Fingers, all these, like, you know, wildly popular.
I mean, literally like era defining bands,
yeah,
right?
Like, right? Yeah, yeah. They're like the biggest bands, you know, of the time, and certainly the biggest bands for as far as like youth was concerned. And, you know, and of course, a lot of this music was quite nihilistic and quite angry, and and the far right, as you'd imagine. Because I saw this and thought, well, we need to emulate that. We need to try and copy that success. And a lot of them were really heavily into, you know, like some of the punk bands, particularly Sham 69, who were, I guess, kind of like a proto oi band of the time. And they, you know, they thought that they could successfully carve out that space as their own. And so in response to Rock Against Racism, I think the year after, they set up, members of the National Front set up Rock Against Communism. But at first, that didn't really find much traction, I think partly because of internal dynamics. John Tyndall at the time was the leader of the National Front, and he really didn't understand or like this music. He was suspicious of this and he didn't like it, and so he didn't want them. He also was worried about them kind of tarnishing the image in the eyes of the electorate.
I mean, Tyndall was born in the 1920s? I don't know.
I think he probably didn't consider this to be authentically white music, you know. And he was convinced that the pop music was a way that so-called white culture was being eroded. So, you know, he never really gave them the space or the free rein to really do anything effective with that. But then after, like, you know, the 1979 general election, when they were expecting to do quite well and they did it abysmally, and, you know, then after that, the fallout from that saw the National Front kind of shatter into different groups. And the people that remained within the National Front, because John Tyndall left, then all of a sudden had this, you know, had the autonomy to do this a bit more seriously. And they, you know, they, I think Joe Pearce was probably the key figure there. He was, I think, in the young National Front at the time, and he set up, you know, Bulldog magazine, and then he kind of relaunched Rock Against Communism, and he was mates with Ian Stuart Donaldson, who of course is the lead singer of Screwdriver.
Yeah, probably everyone knows that was the fascist band.
That is exactly it, the fascist band. Yeah, I mean, they were, at that point in time, they split up for a bit, and Joe Pearce, I don't know if he convinced them to get back together, but they got back together, and certainly Joe Pearce, you know, got them to be basically the National Front's house band, which was very successful. You know, it was quite a savvy thing to do, and it did attract a lot of attention, not just in England, but in America and, you know, in Europe. And yeah, so that this kind of relaunched Rock Against Communism was wildly successful, really. And then off the back of that, the National Front put together their I think it was the White Noise Records and then the White Noise Club, which was like a distribution network and a separate music organization to kind of capitalize on this. And they made a lot of money out of not just Screwdriver, but, you know, No Remorse, you know, a lot of other white power oi bands. Then they, I think they also had like a yearly festival as well, which, you know, attracted a lot of people from around Europe. But eventually Ian Stuart Donaldson got a bit miffed with them, because he, you know, he probably rightly suspected that they were, you know, creaming money off of Screwdriver's income to support the National Front. And so he left and he formed Blood and Honour in, it would have been like 1987, actually. It would have, yeah, 1987, I think. And Blood and Honour were even more successful, you know, because they weren't tied to the National Front. So they weren't like a party political organization. They were just about the music and, you know, more broadly the ideology. And they were wildly successful. You know, they had very, you know, in a few years, they had branches all across Europe and Canada, the United States, Australia. You know, they were selling thousands of records, merchandise. So I don't know if this has answered your question. I've just been rambling a bit, but that's kind of like the history of, and the reach, I suppose, of the far right's musical endeavors across the 80s and into the 90s. Of course, Ian Stuart Donaldson then died in 93, and then it's quite interesting. Then there's a bit of a tug of war over who gets gets ownership of that. And for a while, Combat 18 actually were in control of that side of things, and were raking in lots of money from it as well.
No, I think that's super useful just to get people like set in the context. I mean, just a question on that as well. Like, I guess a lot, we can't really talk about this kind of stuff without talking about skinhead culture in some ways.
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know, we have this image, I suppose, a popular image of the far right skinhead, you know, this is England and this kind of stuff. And that was one part of the movement for certain, but the roots of skinhead, the skinhead scene and culture, was in the 60s and in reggae and ska and in black music.
That's right, yeah.
I find that super interesting in that there was these kind of white power racist skinheads were inserting themselves into what was a multicultural or a mixed music.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, and of course, the skinhead subculture went back to the 60s, as you say, where it was kind of like drawing on the preceding mod subculture and, like you say, like rude boy, you know, Jamaican culture, reggae, ska. Yeah, and then, you know, when you get to the late 70s, that the far right did try and co-opt it, and they did try and make it out to be, you know, a white scene. It was always a very working class subculture, so I think, you know, that's partly what attracted the far right to it. But yeah, this was something that, you know, the anti-fascists and the far right, you know, bitterly fought over. And Cable Street Beat, you know, they did their best to, I mean, they put on like Oi Against Fascism gigs where they had like The Oppressed, you know, Angelic Upstarts and other Oi bands playing. And I think really overall, like the anti-fascists were considerably more successful than the far right were in operating within that space, partly because of the way anti-fascists dealt with, you know, Blood and Honor and other far right groups. But I mean, the far right ended up having to just really operate within their own kind of micro scene. They were kind of rejected by the wider punk and Oi scenes. And I suppose the other element of, because I mean, at this point, I suppose in the late 70s and 80s, you know, the skinhead culture is on one side, it's Oi music, and the other side, it's two-tone at that point. And two-tone obviously was very anti-racist. I mean, the whole point of it was, it was two-tone. It was black and white musicians together. Although I think originally the two-tone phrase refers to a material that skinheads wore, but nevertheless it did come very quickly to symbolize, you know, racial unity. So there were a lot of fights over that, but I do think, yeah, the anti-fascists were more successful in operating in that space.
We've like used the term militant quite a fair bit in so far, and I think I know what I mean by militant, but I was wondering, what's your distinction between militant and moderate? Because I think there's probably a danger in using militant as like a code word for violence or violent action. Of course, you know, violence, political violence is a big part of AFA. But I think militant goes beyond that particular activity. And I wondered what you thought about it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I consider militant to be broader than violence. Certainly it's direct action, I'd say in a broader sense. Yeah, certainly does include violence, and I don't think you can kind of brush over that, but at the same time I think it is, you know, it's occupying spaces, it's
and I guess there's also like an anti-state element to this, which is another big distinction. Like if you're trying to separate out the two wings of anti-fascism, then, you know, AFA were extremely anti-state, rejected working with the police, for example, or, you know, this was an idea that, you know, anti-fascism is something we need to take on ourselves and do it as a movement, as ourselves, rather than to appealing to some kind of state authority or state intervention.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in fact, they stated that, you know, anti-fascism, you can't work with the police, really. And that led to some disagreements, of course, within the movement, because, you know, the groups like Searchlight were very happy to work with the police. And in fact, in similar cultural terms as well, they worked with the police to shut down a Rock Against Communism festival. But those kinds of distinctions did lead to disagreements, right, to disunity within anti-fascism more generally. But I mean, it's an interesting area.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, maybe coming back to these idea of politicized youth scenes and thinking about that into the context of today, like I think one process which I suppose started in the 80s, went on for a bit longer, but is this kind of like dissolution of civil society, or, you know, like kind of, yeah, civil, like, you know, the kind of things like unions or like clubs or like very kind of physical in-person scenes like Oi scenes, for example.
Yeah.
Is something that has started to fall apart in many ways, and be a lot more atomized as a society, just because, you know, people communicate online and you know, various material factors, including like the need to work and the fact that there is not really a squatters movement to speak of anymore.
No.
Do you know what I mean? All these kind of different things.
There's also kind of a lot less public ownership, right? Like spaces are often more privately owned. There isn't like the, you know, there aren't quite the same number of like communal spaces where perhaps, you know, you could have met with other people and arrange stuff like this. And you're right, yeah, there is the push to online as well. You know, that more people online doesn't equate to, you know, connecting online doesn't equate to people meeting up in real life at all. But then I think there is, you know, there are some interesting exceptions to that. I mean, you know, if you look at, I think Clapton CFC, where like that's owned by the fans, right? The Clapton Community Football Club, and they put on loads of gigs, and they, you know, and they put on lots of events. So, you know, the definitely that's the trend, that's the direction the trend's going in. But I think there are noteworthy exceptions.
Definitely. Maybe moving on a little bit from, we'll come back to it, obviously, but Cable Street Beat, in the, you know, just looking at a kind of how long it lasted, didn't last too long. Like,
no,
it was like 88 to early 90s, I guess.
Yeah, about 92, 93. Yeah. Although it did, so it kind of wound down at that point, largely, I think, because, well, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think because they were kind of a victim of their own success, in as much as they, like, some of the major campaigns they'd run were to, first of all, get Blood and Honour out of London, specifically Ian Stuart Donaldson, which they did. They kind of chased him out, and they made it very difficult for Blood and Honour to put on gigs there. But there were also,
if you just look at some of the stories of what was done to Ian Stuart Donaldson before his death, it was like, you know, he was having his door put in regularly, and like, yeah, just attacked on the street. Like, the man couldn't catch a break, and I mean, rightly, but like,
yeah. He wasn't having a good time. Yeah, no. It is hard to feel much sympathy for him. Yeah, so he was kind of chased out of London. I think he went up to Leicester or somewhere. But yeah, so he left, which kind of left them without that target. And another kind of campaign of theirs was shutting down a couple of stores called the Merc and Cut Down, who were like on just off Carnaby Street, and were selling far right material and, you know, far right Blood and Honour records and merch. And they led these big campaigns that were successful in the end. And they, you know, these shops were forced to, first of all, move, and then I think at least one of them had to close. And then
there's a story in Beating the Fascists of after getting a Labour councillor to visit shops and petition them to like remove their racist merch, and him being quite surprised about how amenable these shops were to his request, and then after saying, you know, there was two massive guys standing behind him the whole time giving them the eye, and therefore their attitude was a little bit different. But yeah,
no, that's interesting. And of course, in the same book, they talk about how after one of the shops was forced to move, it was visited by anti-fascists in the night who had sledgehammers and broke their way in and destroyed a lot of the merchandise in there. So, I mean, that was a successful campaign, you know. And then after that, they were kind of, you know, without obvious local targets. And at the same time, I think that would have been about when the Anti-Nazi League was reforming. And so it's kind of, there was like a lot more competition in that like kind of political marketplace. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was harder to attract the same support and the same attention, you know. But then Anti-Fascist Action did carry on doing, you know, musical endeavors throughout the 90s, both in terms of, you know, gigs and their unity festivals and their dance music freedom of movement campaign.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could talk a bit about that, because I actually didn't know anything about this. Like, I was well aware of the kind of battles between the punk and oi and that kind of thing, but the intervention into dance music is I think really interesting, and speaks to a kind of ability on AFA's part to adapt to, I guess, the cultural moment in this, whereas, as you know, you go into the 90s, house music becomes a much bigger thing, and clubs are massive.
Yeah.
And then they saw an opportunity to intervene. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the Freedom of Movement campaign.
Yeah, sure, certainly. Yeah, I think it's interesting in general, just because people often kind of think about dance music as being completely apolitical, you know, if you're being unkind, some writers have described it as, you know, as shallow and hedonistic. I don't think that's particularly fair, but there is actually, you know, a bit of a history of people being, you know, running political campaigns or at least politicizing that subculture. For instance, you know, the opposition to the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act in 94. You know, there are a lot of like raves put on kind of against that, to raise, you know, to combat that. And also in the Netherlands, I don't know how familiar you are with GABA, but like that was a
mildly aware.
So I mean, I it's hard to listen to personally, because yeah, it's just so aggressive and it's like very fast, loud, angry noise. But that was kind of a site of contestation between the far right and anti-fascists. And I think one of the major record labels there, called Mocum Records, like to this day has hardcore against racism and fascism written on like all its merch. So, you know, there is like form there, you know, there is actually a history of politicized dance music. But freedom of movement, that kind of emerged in, I think, 93. And like you say, that was a point at which, you know, that dance music was becoming, you know, probably the main focus of like youth culture, right? It was becoming wildly popular. You know, you had like the Hacienda and Cream and clubs like that were attracting huge numbers of people every weekend. And it was the Manchester branch of Anti-Fascist Action, along with some DJs in Manchester. I think Justin Robertson, I think, was the main, like the leader of that in terms of DJs. They kind of reasoned that clubs were, you know, the culture around it wasn't something that could exist under fascism, right? Like it was kind of about unity, and you know, you had people of different ethnicities and sexualities all together having fun. So it was very antithetical to like the far right, and they thought, you know, that kind of that makes it an area where perhaps people would be amenable to anti-fascism. So they put on. They got the Freedom of Movement campaign together. They got a load of, you know, relatively prominent artists like the Drum Club, Fundamental, people like that. And yeah, they held like club nights all over the country, you know, in Scotland as well, and Leeds and London, Nottingham, Manchester, obviously. And yeah, they were, by all accounts, they were very well attended. This is something I found it harder to get information on this. I've found people who are involved in Cable Street B who are very willing to talk to me. And then like through them, I've been trying to find people who are involved in the freedom movement. But I mean, it was, you know, like 30, 40 years ago now. So I guess it's not surprising, but I don't know enough about it. I don't know as much as I'd like. But they also put out a double album called This Is Fascism, which was the new fads, you know, Automatic Daffodils covering Consolidated song This Is Fascism, and then I think there was a bunch of remixes of that by, again, the same DJs, and I think Carl Cox was one of the people that contributed to that CD. So yeah, I mean, it was, you know, they achieved quite a lot. They put on a load of events, they put out a double album, but it's not something that has really come up on people's radar much, which is a shame, because there's not really been anything like it since then in England, in, you know, as far as I'm aware, in that cultural space.
I suppose you'd have some thoughts about this, but it's so important that these kind of histories are not lost, you know. Like, I think part of the nature of AFA, or part of the nature of these movements, was they were quite clandestine. People didn't necessarily admit to membership, or for good reason, you know, like state intervention and surveillance and things like that. And so there isn't, you know, the same kind of contemporaneous kind of writings or like testimonies from people. And so I suppose a lot of the work, I mean, the work that you're engaging in with your articles is a kind of rescuing some of that and finding it and getting it written down.
Yeah, I mean, that's the aim, because I, you know, both Cable Street B and Freedom Movement and you know, the other cultural things that AFA did, they did attract thousands of people. There were a lot of people involved. You know, it did have. I think a great deal of impact. And like you say, because it kind of stems from AFA, who did have to kind of keep a lid on things and not be too public with who they are and what they were doing. It's difficult to find people who are very willing to talk about their involvement, which is a shame, but it's understandable. So I mean, it'd be a shame if these things were lost to time. And yeah, I am trying to get a few articles out on this area. Yeah,
I guess maybe looking at the Cable Street Beat and looking at AFA's cultural, other kind of cultural work with the benefit of hindsight, you know, many many decades of hindsight now. I wonder what conclusions you're drawing from this kind of stuff, because in the show we're like, I think a running theme is like finding things in history and thinking about the relevance for today and what it means for us right now. And yeah, I guess we haven't seen that similar kind of cultural anti-fascism for a while. I mean, obviously Clapton is a notable example, but you know, otherwise, especially within the music scene, I don't want to say it's apolitical, because obviously there's a lot of work around anti-racism within the music scene and coming out of the music scene. But yeah, I just wondered, what can we draw from this for today?
I think that Cable Street Beat and Rock Against Racism both kind of show that that music is a fantastic way to get people together, to raise consciousness, you know, to get across ideas. I was speaking to, you know, Attila the Stockbroker?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I was speaking to him this week, you know, for some research I'm doing. I should stress he very enthusiastically waived his anonymity when I asked him about that. But he was saying that, you know, in the 80s, when the far right were frequently attacking, you know, gigs, on more than one occasion, you know, he'd get up and he'd play and he'd recite poetry, and he'd managed to get through to some of the younger, like, far right thugs that had come to attack him, and he'd start a dialogue and he'd change some minds. And, you know, that's hugely, hugely powerful, being able to do that. And yeah, you know, I think people are more, you'll find more people who are willing to go to a gig than are willing to go to a political meeting, you know. It's more exciting, it's more accessible,
it's just way more fun, let's be honest.
It's just fun. I love politics, but I do get very bored with political meetings. But I love gigs. They're so exciting, and they do unify people, you know, they bring them together. So if you can attract people who aren't political through music, you can start that conversation, you can get ideas across, you know, you can change minds and raise consciousness. And it's just, yeah, it's a tried and tested method, you know. It's been done so effectively, both by Cable Street Beat and Rock Against Racism, and I'm sure there are other, you know, lots of examples around the world. So in terms of what lessons we can draw, I mean, it's been proven that this works. So, you know, if we can carry on putting on gigs, events, festivals, then I think that that's going to continue to be a good way to convert people. And yeah, I think people are doing that. I don't know if it's perhaps becoming more prevalent again, but, like, you know, a few years ago in New York, there was the Black Fads over Brooklyn, I think it was called. It was like Kim Kelly organized it. It was an anti-fascist black metal festival. Mm-hmm. And there's also, like, you know, there's been the rise of red and anarchist black metal, and there's the anti-fascist black metal network. So, you know, and that was all in response to National Socialist black metal. So, there's that. I think that in Edinburgh a few years ago, and in Paris recently, there's been quite a few anti-fascist hip hop gigs. I think in Edinburgh that was done by Anti-Fascist Action, and there was a blog called Interregnum. So, you know, they raised money, they attracted people, they you know, raised the profile of the cause. And a few years ago in England, there was, I don't know if you remember, but in 2005, the BNP tried to co-opt the English folk scene.
Which led to this.
Right, yeah, it's not particularly it's not well known, I don't think. So in about 2005, I think it was, I think at that point the BNP, they had I think it was Great White Records, and they started putting out folk and started claiming that, like, English folk bands, like, the only authentic English music, and saying how much they liked them. But that, of course, pissed off a lot of people who are prominent in English folk, like Eliza Carthy and Cher of Hands and the Levellers. That ended up resulted in the formation of the Folk Against Fascism campaign, which was really good. And there were kind of branches, you know, around lots of different kind of university cities and a lot of events in London and elsewhere. And I think a couple of CDs were put out. I think Chumbawamba were probably involved in that as well, because at that point they were a folk band. So, you know, I'm kind of going on a bit there, but there has been, you know, a lot of noteworthy examples of anti-fascists and leftists in the last kind of 20 years, effectively using music to recruit people, to get ideas across, to raise money, to build networks.
Another example, which is after the mass arrest of 286 anti-fascists in Tower Hamlets, London anti-fascists put on a gig, I think, at what was the old University of London Union, which is now no longer exists, to raise money for their legal costs, right, and legal defences. So, like, yeah, I guess it speaks to a kind of phenomenon that, like, how anti-fascism is necessarily a responsive or reactive movement to what is happening on the far right and how the far right are acting as well. Like, if you look at, like groups in America, where their phrase is we'll go where they go, you know, we'll be where they are, right? Like, and so if the far right are not trying it on in music scenes, or not trying to build their own racist music scene, then there's not much need for anti-fascists to necessarily be there. I mean, that's devoid from, like, the usefulness or utility of music to communicate, you know, liberatory or other kind of lefty ideas. But yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there is this idea in like social movement theory of like abeyance structures. I don't know if you're aware of that, but they're kind of like networks of a social movement that kind of sustain a social movement in periods of inactivity or kind of hostile circumstances. And I mean, I would argue that Cable Street Beat and AFA's musical endeavors did that very well, actually. And in fact, I was speaking to someone who was involved in both in the last couple of weeks, and they were like, yeah, absolutely, that completely describes what it did for the scene, you know. I think a couple of times in particular, so in like, I think in 1989 or 1990, within anti-fascist action, there was a lot of turmoil between the more moderate and the more militant sort of wings of the group, which kind of led to paralysis and AFA briefly kind of falling apart. But whilst all that happened, at Cable Street Beat was still, you know, it was still going strong, and it was still arranging gigs, and it was still getting people active and involved. And also, like, towards the end of the 90s, when you know, the BNP were moving away from streets, from kind of street politics, I think the phrase they used was no more meetings, marches, or punch-ups, right? That was the famous phrase that the BNP used at the time.
The three rules.
Yeah. So that, yeah, they, you know, they were trying to present themselves as a respectable party, and so we're not going to have punch-ups with the far right with anti-fascists anymore, and we're not going to give them a target. And actually, that was, unfortunately, you know, a relatively effective way of scuppering the anti-fascist scene. But for a while, you know, anti-fascist action and Cable Street Beat was kind of relaunched and towards the end of the 90s, or maybe towards the end of the 90s, and they were quite successful for a while. You know, they put lots of different branches, put on gigs, you know, they raised funds, they operated in different musical scenes, and yeah, they kept things going, even though there wasn't really, you know, an obvious fascist target. So yeah, it as you say, it kind of gives succor and sustenance to the movement.
I mean, I think it's also quite like a straightforward, what's the word, it's like there's quite an obvious toolkit there to putting on your own anti-fascist gig. It's not like it takes that much. You like find a space, find a band with a big enough following, and ask them to play it, and then call the gig an anti-fascist gig, and then you're on your way, basically. Like,
yeah, that's it. Yeah, it is like you say that I mean, there's just very simple steps, isn't it? And there is already, you know, there is that scene, there are those kind of cultural resources to draw on. You know, there are very overtly anti-fascist bands kicking around London, kicking around everywhere, really. And you know, generally speaking, they're going to be, well, I can't really speak for them, but generally speaking, you know, an anti-fascist band is going to want to support anti-fascists, and we'll if they can, we'll play for you if you're going to put on an anti-fascist gig. And also the flip side of you know, the what we're saying about the, you know, the shift to everyone being online, is that it does make it easier to then publicize that, to get across to hundreds of people quickly that this gig is going on, right? So yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of work involved behind all that, but the those steps are clear, you know.
I mean, just going back to the thing about atomization and the closure of like a lot of independent music venues is a problem for definite, because, you know, I can't imagine anyone, you know, putting something on in the Brixton Academy, for example, or you know, these big venues, because they're booked out with massively commercial bands and making a lot of money for them, and two, you know, those kind of conglomerates that now own those venues are, you know, part of the ruling class, as it were. You know, I don't know how to describe it, but like,
no, absolutely. And they might, they may very well shy away from putting on bands that are associated with anti-fascism. So yeah, I mean, and they're probably prohibitively expensive as well, right? So it's a real loss that we're losing, you know, those music venues, and more generally that, you know, publicly owned spaces is kind of declining, because yeah, I mean, they would have been where you could have done this a lot more easily.
Just thinking about, I guess, more about today and the contemporary moment, I kind of feel like there's not enough analysis about what's going on right now. And I know obviously you're a historian and it's, you mainly talk about history, but you kind of look at the kind of things that are going on in Europe and the capture of various governments by far-right parties, and I guess in the UK we haven't necessarily seen it yet in that way and or to that extent. We've got groups like Patriotic Alternative and Hope, the Homeland Party, and these kind of things are kind of trying to build some kind of broader based thing that's not like mad terrorists of National Action or the kind of street movement of the EDL. I guess maybe just thinking in the terms of the next 5 years or the next 10 years, like, what do you think is going to happen? Because I've been thinking about this a lot.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Conservative Party have always been quite good at kind of outflanking the far right and kind of sucking up their electoral support, certainly. Like, I mean, in 1979, when the National Front looked like they were going to break through electorally, part of the reason they didn't is because Thatcher very famously, you know, went on TV and said that people feel like they're being swamped by immigrants. So I do think that it's hard for the far right to kind of get a foothold, because the Tory party is quite good at swooping in and, you know, and doing things like the hostile environment. And also, I mean, you know, historically the far right in the UK just hasn't been particularly good at capitalizing on what should be quite beneficial circumstances, you know. Yeah, I don't know why that is, but they you know, they keep dropping the ball, which is good. But, you know, we've had, like, recently this, you know, this, I hate the phrase, but the so-called migrant crisis and, you know, and Brexit and lots of things that you'd think would kind of add sucker to their cause and mobilize them, but they can't really capitalize on that. They don't seem to be able to.
I mean, we'll have to, it's an unfair question really, because literally we don't know, but
no, quite, yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I suppose the it depends also what's happening elsewhere in the world, doesn't it? Because, you know, what happens here isn't happening in isolation. You know, if Donald Trump wins, that'll probably change things. You know, if more far right parties get to power in across Europe, that's going to change things as well. You know, there's going to be that network then of far right groups with more sway and more resources. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be as well in, like, the over the course of the 2010s that, like, every time there was a European election, you know, there'd be certain skirmishes around various far-right parties who could come and, like, try and appeal to immigrant, you know, their base in the UK. And you know, you saw the kind of immigrants, anti-fascist immigrants in the UK take the lead on opposing them as well. And obviously, yes. Now, obviously, isn't in the EU necessarily, but, like, these, we can't, like, divest, you can't, like, seal off Britain from what's going on. So, yeah.
No, exactly, yeah.
All right. I think that was, we're almost done. Yeah, I know you wanted to have a quick shout out for your particular project. So you're looking for more, I suppose, people who were involved in Cable Street Beat to get in touch with you, right?
I am Cable Street Beat and Freedom of Movement, perhaps. But also, I mean, I'm also at the minute trying to kind of sketch out the history of anti-fascist music in London specifically, and more the kind of the untold, I suppose, elements of that. So I'm less interested in Rock Against Racism and Love Music, Hate Racism. But so anyone basically that's been involved in it, broadly the anti-fascist music scene in London in any genre as an artist, an organizer, an activist, I'd very much like to talk to you about your involvement and your experiences. Yeah, so please do get in touch.
What's the best way for people to contact you?
Well, actually, they could get to me through the Conversation article that I published recently. I think there's, like, a reach out to this writer function on there, which I think is how you got to me, actually. So I published an article called "Through Cable Street Beat, Music Became a Potent Anti-Fascist Weapon Against the Far Right," and it's on The Conversation, which is theconversation.com.
There's just a button at the bottom of the article. You just click it, and you can send a message through there.
It's great, yeah. Easy. So if anyone can do that, anyone who's involved in the anti-fascist music in London can do that. That would be great.
And I guess people could also get in touch via us as well. So on our social media.
Yeah, if that's okay with you. Yeah.
So 12rulesforwhat@gmail.com is the email. So if you want me to pass on your details, then you can get in touch through us too.
Yes, brilliant. Thank you very much.
No worries. What, I know you've got one more thing coming out. When's your article coming out? Which is what we've based some of our discussion on.
Yeah, so this article on Cable Street Beat is coming out this month, and it's coming out in the journal Participation and Conflict, or PACO. So if you type in PACO journal on Google, you'll find it. And it's going to be open access. Free to read it. And it's also actually, it's going to be part of a broader special edition on Antifa from below. Great. So lots of great writers are going to be in that issue, like Ali Jones at Coventry. So yeah, so it'll be out this month. So please do have a look and read.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Alex. This was a really great conversation.
No, thank you, Alex. Yeah.
Okay. I haven't got much to say. If you would like to support us on Patreon, you can do that at patreon.com/12rulesforwhat. And like I said, if you want to get in touch, it's 12rulesforwhat@gmail.com. But if not, thank you for listening and goodbye.